Good day, and welcome to the What's Next, Obergefell versus Hodges conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Jill Dash. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jill Dash, Vice President of Strategic Engagement here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you so much for joining us for today's call, What's Next, Obergefell versus Hodges. Please note that today's call is being recorded, and the recording will be available after the call. This is the second in our summer series of What's Next calls, where experts in our network discuss this U.S. Supreme Court term. I'm happy to say that 0.5 hours of California CLE credit will be available for this call. If you are interested in obtaining CLE, please email Matt Scoble. His email is M as in Mary, S-C-O-B-L-E at acslaw.org. In order to get credit, you'll need to email Matt. We will invite everyone to ask questions at the end of the call. I want to say welcome to our friends at the American Constitution Society. And for those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a national member of ACS today. It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce Camilla Taylor, Marriage Project Director in the Midwest Regional Office of Lambda Legal. Camilla was lead counsel in Lambda Legal's marriage equality lawsuit in Iowa, Barnum versus O'Brien, which seems like just yesterday and yet now a million years ago, in which the Iowa Supreme Court by unanimous decision struck down Iowa's marriage ban in April 2009, making Iowa the third state in the country to permit gay and lesbian couples to marry. She has also been counsel in the cases challenging Indiana's and Louisiana's marriage bans. And most importantly, for today's purposes, she was counsel in the consolidated cases for Obergefell. Also very important to ACS, she sits on the Chicago Lawyer Chapter's Board of Advisors. We are very happy to have her there. I am thrilled to introduce to you today our speaker, Camilla Taylor. Go ahead, Camilla.
Thanks so much, Jill, and thanks to ACS as well for having me. ACS is so dear to my heart, and it's a great pleasure and an honor to be able to talk to you today. What an incredible day. It is hard to put our emotions in words. We received a sweeping victory in Obergefell. It's a wonderful affirmation of the equal right to personhood of lesbian and gay people in this country, and the decision really is remarkable in its language, its tone, and in its celebration of marriage itself. So to speak a little bit about the doctrinal basis for this decision, the court decides that denying same-sex couples the freedom to marry infringes on the fundamental right to marry protected by the 14th Amendment. It is both a decision that is grounded in the Due Process Clause, namely the fundamental right to marry, but it is also discrimination with respect to exercise of a fundamental right in violation of the Equal Protection Guarantee to deny same-sex couples the freedom to marry or recognition of their existing marriages. So 14 states that currently have denied same-sex couples the freedom to marry will now have to fall in line with the majority of states in this country that already do allow same-sex couples to marry. The court makes clear that the fundamental right to marry is about dignity and autonomy. It writes, "The first premise of this court's relevant precedence is that the right to personal choice regarding marriage is inherent in the concept of individual autonomy. This abiding connection between marriage and liberty is why Loving invalidated interracial marriage bans under the Due Process Clause." And that's a reference to Loving versus Virginia, the 1967 case that struck down bans on interracial marriage. And that reliance on Loving versus Virginia infuses the majority opinion. It's a 5-4 opinion, and the court relies repeatedly on Loving versus Virginia. The court then says that the nature of marriage is that through its enduring bond, two persons together can find other freedoms, such as expression, intimacy, and spirituality. This is true for all persons, whatever their sexual orientation. and it expressly recognizes that same-sex couples have the same freedom of association, their right to intimate association, that other couples do. So as was true of the Windsor and Lawrence decisions, this is an equal liberty and equal dignity holding. It infuses equal protection and due process principles, and there's explicit reliance on past cases that also do that, not just Loving versus Virginia, but also Zablocki and Eisenstadt and Griswold, cases that arose in the context of sex discrimination and the access to contraceptives. They were wonderful cases brought by our foremothers. So in addition to this decision being such a wonderful affirmation of the fundamental right to marry for all of us, it explicitly recognizes that it's more than that. It is a recognition of our common humanity and our right to equal dignity. The court, in talking about the history of discrimination against gay people, says that for a time, because of that discrimination, a truthful declaration by same-sex couples of what was in their heart had to remain unspoken, because lesbian and gay people were criminalized. Even when a greater awareness of the humanity and integrity of homosexual persons came in the period after World War II, the argument that gays and lesbians had a just claim to dignity was in conflict with both law and widespread social conventions. So the court is saying that it is vindicating that integrity and that dignity here in the Obergefell case. The court also shows great reverence for the institution of marriage itself, and I think there's plenty of fodder here for quotes that will be used in marriage ceremonies throughout the summer and indeed for years to come. The court says that marriage responds to the universal fear that a lonely person might call out only to find no one there. It offers the hope of companionship and understanding and assurance that while both still live, there will be someone to care for the other. And then the very last quote brought all of us to tears. The last few words of the decision announcing its holding state, "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." And in responding to the dissenters, each one of the dissenters wrote their own dissent. The dissenters quarreled with the court and argued that it was best for the court to leave the freedom to marry for same-sex couples up to state legislatures. And so the court pointed back to its own decision in Lawrence in explaining why that was not appropriate here, because it was a constitutional guarantee at stake. And the court writes, "While Lawrence confirmed a dimension of freedom that allows individuals to engage in intimate association without criminal liability, it does not follow that freedom stops there. Outlaw to outcast may be a step forward, but it does not achieve the full promise of liberty." And then the court writes that although Bowers versus Hardwick, the incorrect decision that preceded Lawrence and had allowed sodomy laws to stand, and allowed people to continue to be criminalized for being lesbian and gay, the court writes that although Bowers was eventually repudiated in Lawrence, men and women were harmed in the interim, and the substantial effects of these injuries no doubt lingered long after Bowers was overruled. Dignitary wounds cannot always be healed with the stroke of a pen. The court describes all of the litigation and the referenda and the scholarship that has happened on marriage for same-sex couples in the last couple of decades, and talks about how it is not too soon for the court to act because there has been so much discussion already about this issue and so much public debate. And in fact, it attaches as Appendix A to its opinion, really a collection of our movement's greatest hits. All of the district court decisions and circuit court of appeals decisions that have considered marriage bans, the vast majority of them striking them down. And it also uses familiar quotes from the Schuette case, Schuette versus BAMN, which was the decision that upheld a referendum in Michigan that took race off the table as a permissible consideration for government. And in that decision, there was a sort of a paean to the democratic process that Kennedy had written. And Justice Kennedy points out that Schuette still said that where laws cause harm to individuals and violate constitutional guarantees, then the court must step in. So it recognizes that the court was obliged to do this ruling under the constitutional guarantees of liberty and equality. And the court also expressly again recognizes that our understanding of liberty is one that evolves over time. The court writes, "The nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own times. The generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all of its dimensions, and so they entrusted to future generations a charter protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. When new insight reveals discord between the Constitution's central protections and a received legal stricture, a claim to liberty must be addressed." Once again in this decision also, Justice Kennedy, speaking for the majority, recognized the harms imposed by this law, not only on same-sex couples, but to their children as well. And this is one of a growing number of decisions now in constitutional jurisprudence with this court that has recognized the harm caused by an unconstitutional law really as part of their constitutional analysis. And so that harm is one of the reasons why the law must be struck down. And with respect to children, the court recognizes that one of the purposes of marriage is to safeguard families, including children of the marriage. And the court talks about the dignitary impact to children of marriage bans, which declare that their families are not worthy of the same respect that is due other families. So that is another significant aspect of this ruling. With respect to what comes next, all of us, of course, are overjoyed by the sweeping nature of this decision, and we're going to be working very hard in the next days and weeks to implement it to its fullest extent. One of the things that we're going to be trying to do is to make sure that states, in recognizing marriages for same-sex couples, recognize that same-sex couples are due all of the rights and protections and benefits that go along with marriage, and that states don't try and give them some version of marriage light by carving off rights and protections specifically for same-sex couples and their kids. One of the things that I think is very useful in this decision is that it makes explicit that for children, the ability to have a birth certificate listing both spouses as parents upon birth is a right that comes along with being married. And it's one of the things that the court expressly recognizes. And so there's some litigation currently in some states about that, and I think that this case will help to resolve that. In addition, I think this decision will highlight the fact that still in a majority of states in the country, there is no express protection from employment discrimination or discrimination by public accommodations with respect to sexual orientation or gender identity. And so we have a lot of work to do to make sure that same-sex couples can go and get married and then not have to fear that the fact of their marriage, which is public record, will cause them to be fired the following day at work. They'll be able to put a picture of their spouse on their desk at work just like anybody else. We also, of course, anticipate a great deal of pushback in state legislatures and perhaps by local officials who may try to resist or disrespect this decision. In response to that possibility, the court actually includes a statement about religious liberty, saying that religious liberty already enjoys protection, and they emphasize that, of course, churches can continue to make determinations for themselves about whom a church will marry and who is ineligible to marry, and that the First Amendment ensures that choice, ensures that churches enjoy that protection, and this is not disturbed by this ruling. You know, we're still looking, however, at an environment in which more than 100 bills have been introduced in state legislatures that purport to allow religious refusals to serve people in various contexts. And we're going to have to work very hard to make sure that our opponents do not use this sweeping victory as some sort of vehicle for getting past religious refusal laws that could be very harmful. And I know I've been speaking a lot, so maybe I'll close simply by saying that as we look to the days and months ahead, we have to recognize that no Supreme Court decision, no matter how sweeping an affirmation of our humanity and equal liberty, no Supreme Court decision is ever the end of a civil rights struggle. The court relied heavily on hard-won precedents obtained by the civil rights giants who came before us and paved the way for us, including Loving versus Virginia and Eisenstadt and Griswold. And yet the struggles for racial justice and for an end to sex discrimination continue, and that's particularly evident today as we remember the tragic assassination of Reverend Pinckney and the others who died in Charleston, who remind us of the work that lies ahead in all of these struggles, and including in our own. So we have a great deal of work to do, and our hearts go out to those who are in mourning today in South Carolina. So even while we celebrate, I think we need to keep in mind the long struggle that will be true in the future for our movement as it is for others. And that means a lot of work. But at least today, we have the comfort of knowing that there will be a new generation of children who can find protection in the laws of their state and who can grow up understanding that they and their families are entitled to equal respect in the eyes of their government, no matter who they are and no matter whom they love. So, Jill, would you like to send it to questions now?
Yes, why don't we start taking questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, it is star 1 for questions. If you're using a speakerphone, please be sure your mute function is disengaged to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 for questions, and I'll pause for just a moment. And our first question will come from Joseph Williams of U.S. News and World Report.
Hello. Thanks for hosting this call. I had a question. Ms. Taylor, you spoke about the dissent, and I wanted to know what kind of thoughts you have on Justice Thomas's dissent, where he was comparing the whole question of dignity to whether or not a government can bestow it or take it away. And it seemed like kind of a weird dissent in light of all that's been going on. And I just wanted to know what you make of it.
Well, I of course, disagree with the notion that laws cannot deprive people of the dignity to which they are entitled. I think that there is a very strong stigmatizing impact of discriminatory laws, and the Supreme Court has recognized this, not just in the context of the marriage cases, you know, Windsor now and Obergefell, but also in many significant cases before us, including Brown versus Board of Education, where the court considered a scenario, a hypothetical, in which children of color would enjoy equal tangible resources and yet still be segregated. And the court found that that would still impose harm on the hearts and on the minds of children of color, and in a way that the court ruled might never be able to be undone. And that is because of the way in which our laws impact the way we feel about ourselves. The court reflected this also in the Windsor decision, where the court talked about the harm caused to children of same-sex couples by the federal law known as the Defense of Marriage Act, which denied respect on a federal level to valid marriages of same-sex couples. And the court wrote that this humiliates children of same-sex parents because it interferes with their ability to understand the integrity and the closeness of their own families and their families' concord with their community. So again and again, the court has recognized that there is an intangible effect of discriminatory laws that creates a deep wound. That wound also, that's a word that the court referenced too in talking about the dignitary impact of Bowers versus Hardwick. So I find it hard to see how anyone could challenge that.
Do you think he was being specious or just trying to find a way to vent some frustration here?
Well, I don't question the sincerity of anyone on the court, but I think that the principle that laws cause deep psychological hurt to people is something that is fairly evident to anyone who has been the victim of any sort of state-sanctioned discrimination.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from David Sobelson.
As you noted, the court cited numerous precedents, including Griswold against Connecticut. It actually cited Griswold 7 times. The court didn't once cite Roe against Wade. Is that significant? Should we read anything into that for the future of abortion rights?
I don't think so. I think the court referred again and again to various fundamental rights precedents. And talking about fundamental rights, it talked about how the right to procreative decisions, that is a fundamental right. It's a fundamental right to make decisions about child rearing. So that's an affirmation of what the court has written before about reproductive freedom. And it's also, I think, a very strong recognition of autonomy and personal choice. So when the court writes about what the fundamental right to marry means, the court describes it in a way that makes it very clear that reproductive freedom really falls in that same category. It's about the ability to determine for ourselves what our family should look like and what our future looks like. I mean, actually, to answer your question further, there's a great deal of recognition about how marriage has changed with respect to the treatment of women, too. And it talks about how we now understand marriage to be a very different thing, even though women were subordinated to men with respect to marriage laws in history. And I think that the changing understanding of liberty that the court embraces also should give a lot of hope to those advocates for reproductive freedom who are reading this decision for things that they can take and help to push their movement forward.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question will come from Jonathan Ginterich with UCLA.
Hi. Thanks for running this call. In light of Roberts' dissent, I wondered if you have any insight into the implication of this case for Brown v. Boomin in the Tenth Circuit or for litigation about polyamorous relationships more generally.
I think that those cases involving relationships of more than two people, involve a very different set of justifications for state laws that would prohibit those relationships from having legal recognition. So what I didn't describe, I guess, in great detail in my overview of this case of Obergefell, is that the court went through one by one the justifications that had been given by the states for marriage bans, and described why those justifications had no basis in fact and why they were insufficient to overcome the fact that there was an infringement on the fundamental right that was at work here. So the court talked about the procreation justification that had been given by the states in these cases. The states had argued that marriage bans are necessary because they channel procreation into households with different sex couples, or they somehow link children to their biological parents. That was another justification that the states had cited for trying to uphold marriage bans. And the court writes that an ability, desire, or promise to procreate is not and has not been a prerequisite for a valid marriage in any state, and talks about the non-procreative reasons why some people get married and how important those are. So in the context of a claim brought by someone who wants to marry multiple people, the court would have a different array of justifications to consider. So I don't think that this decision necessarily dictates the outcome for any of those cases.
Was there anything else, sir? Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star 1 if you have a question, and I'll pause for a moment to give everyone time to signal.
While we're waiting, Camilla, let me ask you this question. There's been some discussion about whether it's surprising at all that Chief Justice Roberts couldn't find a way to sign on with the majority. And it seems like he does make his dissent rather personal, saying, doesn't matter what I think, but the law doesn't support this. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I think it is disappointing. And I think it reflects perhaps a lack of understanding about where this country is with respect to recognition of the freedom to marry for same-sex couples. We have seen great social change on this issue over the last couple of decades. We've gone from a position of enjoying only perhaps 40% popular support nationwide, just about a decade ago, to now well over 50% nationwide, and in some polls, about 60% public support for the freedom to marry for same-sex couples. So this is an issue that will not this is an issue where I think there will be a very clear understanding of where the right side of history is. And in just a few years, people will question really only why it took us so long to get here. And so I am disappointed that the Chief Justice couldn't find a way to sign on. And I think that perhaps he will come to regret not having been part of the majority opinion.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one for questions, and we go now to Brian Del Bono of Golden Gate School of Law. Mr. Del Bono, your line is open. You may be on mute.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hi. I applaud the court's decisions today, but I'm cautiously optimistic because of the holding in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. So my question to you is what would you feel the merits of a subsequent suit coming from Hobby Lobby should they decide to go and challenge this because it personally offends their religious mission in a subsequent lawsuit?
That's an excellent question, and our concerns about the arguments that were being made by the corporations in Hobby Lobby led us to file a friend of the court brief in Hobby Lobby in addition to a number of other cases concerning religious objections to provisions in the Affordable Care Act. I think, you know, there are a number of different ways in which the Hobby Lobby decision may be limited. For one thing, it was a recognition that closely held corporations can assert these sort of religious objections, and it's not entirely clear what the court meant by closely held corporations, but that may be one limitation. Another thing to keep in mind is that the court seems to make clear that a government interest in ending racial discrimination, at the very least, would be a compelling interest that would be sufficient to overcome religious objections under the federal RFRA. So whether the court also will consider non-discrimination principles with respect to sexual orientation and gender identity to constitute such a similar compelling governmental interest remains to be seen, and we certainly hope that the court will find that to be true. So there are, I think, reasons for concern about the impact of the Hobby Lobby decision on enforcement of non-discrimination principles with respect to lesbian and gay people and transgender people in the years ahead, but there's also reason to be hopeful. Did that answer your question?
Yes, that answered perfectly. I guess my follow-up question to that, too, is that do we see potentially somebody challenging this decision today head-on by saying this offends my religious right to practice the way that I want. You're forcing me to accept a view that I don't adopt.
Well, yes, absolutely. People are already making that argument. And, in fact, at the Supreme Court, there were a number of amicus or friend of the court briefs that were submitted by people arguing that allowing same-sex couples to marry would somehow create a conflict between religious liberty and equality or liberty principles. It's our position, of course, that there is no such conflict. There's an existing framework for non-discrimination principles, for non-discrimination laws. That existing framework has always permitted enforcement of non-discrimination laws with respect to race and sex, and while there's no federal law that expressly prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, There are certainly a minority of states that prohibit that kind of discrimination, and that framework should remain true, and it's unaffected by this Supreme Court decision for this reason, because already there have been discrimination claims that people have brought who are lesbian or gay because, say, in New Mexico, they tried to have a commitment ceremony and they tried to hire a photographer, and this photography business turned them down, saying that they wouldn't serve lesbian customers in commitment ceremonies. And the New Mexico Supreme Court ruled that this non-discrimination law in New Mexico could be enforced against this business, and that the claim that this was somehow compelled speech or that it was a violation of religious liberty was not well taken, just for the same reasons that religious liberty claims in those contexts have been rejected in the context of, say, Newman versus Piggy Park, which was a decision from decades ago in which a trial court similarly rejected a claim that it violated religious liberty when someone refused to serve people of color in a restaurant. It was a restaurant business that refused to serve them. And that decision was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and non-discrimination laws were allowed to take effect. So, in other words, you shouldn't get a pass from being able to obey required to obey non-discrimination principles simply because you can describe your reluctance to serve people in religious terms. So that's a principle that's not specific to lesbian and gay people. It's not specific to legal marriages. We've certainly seen it play out in the context of states like New Mexico, where people were not even allowed to marry at the time that the Elaine photography decision was decided. So I really think that there's nothing new here, and that those concerns will turn out to be overblown and not borne out in reality.
And just following up on that, though, too, would you anticipate, though, particularly in the 13 states that did not recognize gay marriage, that it would be feasible for them to, in the future, adopt more vigorous religious freedom restoration acts on the state level?
Well, we've already seen that in anticipation of this ruling. In just this legislative session, I think there have been over 100 religious refusal bills that have been proposed in state legislatures around the country. While some have been rejected in various ways or altered as a response to public outcry, others still have passed, and some of them are particularly worrying and harmful, like the one in Michigan that purports to allow social service agencies, publicly funded social service agencies, to refuse to place children with lesbian and gay foster parents or adoptive parents if that social service agency can articulate a religious objection to doing so. So we're already seeing that pushback, and I expect we will see that continue, and that will be one of the things that we'll have to work very hard at in the next few months and potentially years, in an effort to try to make sure that non-discrimination principles continue to be enforced and that people understand that it's not a justification to discriminate simply because you can articulate your desire to discriminate in a religious way.
We move now to Eric Harrington with National Education Association.
Hi, I have a question about what impact do you think that this decision will have on other areas of civil rights laws applicable to LGBT folks, specifically employment, public accommodation, and housing. And on that point, if you could talk about the path that the court didn't take. The court didn't conclude that sexual orientation is a suspect class, and it didn't conclude that that same-sex marriage bans were in illegitimate gender-based classifications.
Yes, those are interesting points. So that what the court did was make clear that there was no presumption of constitutionality that attached to this law because it violated a fundamental right. But the court also talked about the way it targeted same-sex couples and demeaned lesbian and gay people by imposing discrimination on them. And what we're seeing really is a very similar type of analysis to the analysis that the court used in Windsor, where there appeared to be a kind of a balancing where the court looked at the justifications that were cited by government for passing the law and found that they were insufficient to overcome the hurt or the harm that the law imposed on people. So it is a nuanced analysis, but it's certainly not an explicit description of the type of scrutiny that the court is using. I think in some ways this ruling will be extremely helpful in combating future examples of discrimination because the court, for example, cites all of the ways in which marriage confers tangible protections and benefits on a couple, including all sorts of government conferred benefits and rights and responsibilities, but also some private ones, some things like the ability to have automatic hospital visitation rights or the ability to inherit in the absence of a will, the ability to get health insurance. So the court seems to understand that marriage creates this bundle of protections, and if you allow same-sex couples to marry, the implication is that same-sex couples are entitled to that bundle. So whether it's birth certificates for the children of the marriage, listing both spouses as parents, or whether it's health insurance, I think this decision will be very helpful. But you're right, it's not laying out in more explicit terms than we saw previously the type of scrutiny that the court is imposing.
We move now to Jay Shannon.
Hi. I just had a quick question regarding one of the dissents, and I understand that it is a dissent, and I'm curious if anyone could shed some light on it. Specifically, Justice Thomas is distinguishing Loving from the current case, and how we see liberty as freedom from government action and not entitlement to government benefits. And his suggestion is that the state's imprimatur and the financial benefits associated with it are strictly entitlements, whereas Loving, the case regarding litigants who were imprisoned for marrying. And I'm just curious as to how you feel this philosophy carries forward in the judiciary. I understand, again, it's a dissent, but I'm just curious to see what you think about it.
Well, I think that's an incorrect reading of the decision in Loving versus Virginia, which was decided both because the laws in Virginia violated the fundamental right to marry and unequal protection terms. So the court didn't stop with an equal protection ruling, and in fact its first holding was a fundamental right to marry holding in Loving versus Virginia. It talked about the centrality of marriage to our lives and its importance in the country. So I think it's inaccurate to view Loving as somehow different. And in fact, the majority opinion relies on Loving versus Virginia again and again throughout to try to make clear that the fusion of equality and liberty principles in Obergefell is identical to its analysis in Loving. So I guess I would quarrel with that description of the holding in Loving versus Virginia. I understand the implication in that dissent the effort was to try to make past cases appear as about negative rights rather than affirmative rights. But I don't think that is really a correct description of what we've done in the past. I mean, the court also relied on cases like Zablocki, which was about whether you can deprive people who owe child support of the fundamental right to marry, or Turner, which is about whether you can deprive prisoners of the fundamental right to marry. And the court pointed out that in Zablocki and in Eisenstadt, in particular, these were also equal protection and due process cases that used those two doctrines. And they involved an affirmative right to something. So I think it's simply an incorrect, rather revisionist explanation of those holdings.
I agree.
Our next question comes from Ney Montenegro.
Hello. Just had a quick question. Would the majority have been able to get the Chief Justice's vote if the court had ruled no on the first question and yes on the second? And if that would have been the decision, what would have been the next steps for the supporters of today's decision as far as fighting for equal rights?
That's an interesting question, and certainly a lot of us in the weeks and months leading up to this decision were trying to guess how we thought the court would would come down, and it did seem, as we sat there in oral argument, as though there was a lot more comfort among many members of the court with respect to question two, which was simply whether states must respect the existing marriages of same-sex couples entered into in other states. So that was solely the recognition claim. And it did seem as though there was a lot more acceptance of the fact that comity principles in the past in this country have almost always resulted in recognition of out-of-state marriages, even when those marriages violated the state's, home state's public policy, and even when the home state would not have allowed the couple to enter into that marriage within their borders. They still, by default, and with very few exceptions, would recognize marriages taking place in other states. And it did seem as though Justice Roberts and even Justice Alito and Scalia were somewhat sympathetic to that. But it's very difficult to know, of course, how differently their votes might have come down if the majority opinion had looked different. I think that version of an opinion would still have felt like a deep loss to all of us. And the majority opinion explains why. Because to require only respect for out-of-state marriages without requiring states to issue licenses would not have been an affirmation of the common humanity of lesbian and gay people, their equal personhood and their right to equal dignity. It wouldn't have been a recognition that lesbian and gay people and their children are equal members of our society. And it would have allowed a two-tier system in which government would invite discrimination against these families by labeling them as different and somehow less worthy of respect. And I think the majority recognized that over and over again with the sweeping language that they used.
And that concludes our question and answer session. Ms. Dash, I'd like to turn the conference back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you so much. I just want to say thank you once again to Camilla Taylor for leading today's call. We feel very fortunate that she was able to make herself available on short notice to talk about this momentous opinion. And as I said earlier in the call, for those of you who are interested, you can get 0.5 hours of California CLE for listening in on this call. In order to get your CLE credit, you need to email Matt Scobel at mscobel@acslaw.org. And he will give you further instruction about getting CLE credit. This call will be recorded, and it will be available at a later date. Thank you so much to everyone for joining.
And that concludes our call for today. We thank everyone for joining us.